Hello, everyone. It's great to see such a great turnout. And welcome to our next exciting Tech CFO Network event, Artificial Intelligence for CFOs, the Risks and Opportunities. I'm Joe Greaves, along with Mike Dunn, co-chair, our members and help lead our organization, our Tech CFO Networking Steering Committee. We have worked diligently along with our distinguished fully volunteer and steering committee of 10 local CFOs help bring you, our members, some hopefully exciting and interesting current topics with insightful speakers who can help us learn more about the challenges we are and may be facing soon as financial executives in today's business marketplace. Before we get started, I would like to ask everyone on the other than the speakers to turn off your cameras, and if you have questions, to load them in the Q&A question piece, and we will pick those up at about 12:40. I would also like to thank Kate LaLament, who is my marketing manager at Cordia, for all her great efforts to make this and all of our TCN events and committee meetings go well for all of us. Thank you, Kate. Really appreciate all the efforts you do for us. I'm sure everybody feels the same. In addition, I'd like to introduce and thank Steve Ballesteri and his Morgan Franklin firm for sponsoring our DoorDash lunch today. Steve, please feel free to introduce yourself and your firm to everyone now.
Thank you, Joe. Hope everybody can hear me okay. And I don't get to see pictures. It's great to see a lot of old friends, clients in attendance today. And we are very thankful to be here and be asked to sponsor. As Joe said, I'm Steve Ballesteri. For those of you I don't know, I'm a managing director at Morgan Franklin Consulting. For those of you who don't know Morgan Franklin, we are a national consulting firm, very much focused around solving problems in the office of the CFO and working together with their teams as they face their technology transformation challenges, as they face their financial, whether it's accounting or diligence or integration carve-out type challenges. And we work with, you know, clients in a variety of industries across the country. We focus very much on the technology space. I am, for Morgan Franklin, the national leader of the technology, media, and telecommunications practice. I also lead Morgan Franklin's efforts to build and continue to spread our brand through the greater Washington area. It is a great privilege for us to be able to be here sponsoring this group. And I really do look forward to this conversation. So thank you very much for having us, and I will turn it over to the people that you came here to listen to.
All right. Thanks, Steve. And finally, I'd like to introduce Brian Dom, the CFO of Babel Street, as our moderator today. And Brian put this program together, and I really want to thank him for the whole steering committee and all the members for his efforts to make this happen. And so I think you'll find this will be a great program. Brian, it's all yours.
Thanks, Joe. Before I get started, I just want to say congratulations again to Steve. This is Morgan Franklin's 25th year in business. I remember when they get started. They are absolutely outstanding, and I just want everybody to know that because my personal experience has been pretty extensive. I actually used them to do my last IPO, which was 2 years ago, a company called Black Sky that we took through a SPAC. And without them, I'm not sure we would have gotten there. So they were just outstanding people. Totally professional and, strong endorsement from me personally. And so just want to say that. Thanks again, Steve. And I got Chick-fil-A with your $25, so I can't wait to hear into that after this meeting.
Brian is not on our payroll, but I do thank you for those kind words. It's a great testimony, and those are the most important things we hear. So thank you again.
You're welcome. All right, so on to the program. I just want to thank you all for joining us today for what we believe is going to be a highly informative session on artificial intelligence. It's truly a privilege to be moderating today's discussion, and I hope you all took advantage of the DoorDash credits like I did. But let's begin. Last March, about 4 or 5 months ago, KPMG conducted a survey of 300 executives from a cross-section of U.S. and international businesses across industries and geographies, each with revenues exceeding $1 billion. KPMG's objective was to look beyond the hype of generative AI and to understand how enterprises are or intend to take advantage of the technology. And what they found was this. Across industries and functions, more than three quarters of respondents see generative AI as by far the most impactful emerging technology they will use. And 71% plan to implement their first generative AI solution within 2 years. Clearly, artificial intelligence has evolved since its birth in the 1950s. And given the explosive rate of evolution just in the past year, we were compelled to present this topic to our CFO group. I suspect this will not be the last time we discuss AI as a group, and I sincerely hope that today's discussion piques your interest and helps you to think through the opportunity more effectively. I'll start by saying that given all the hype, AI can be somewhat confusing. If you don't believe me, just go to Wikipedia, type in artificial intelligence, and start working through the links. I'm sure you could spend the day. AI, as we all see in the press and in myriad technology marketing materials, is expansive, ever-changing, and seemingly infinitely capable of doing all sorts of remarkable things, some good and some not so good. Our objective today is to cut through the hype and to better understand the essentials of AI. Through a series of questions to our panel, we'll cover the following four objectives. First, what comprises AI and how generative AI fits into that mix? Second, how it's being used today and how it'll be used in the near term. Third, the challenges, risks, and ethical and regulatory issues and concerns it creates. And finally, where we think AI may be heading in the mid and long term. Today, we're joined by an incredible couple of women, Rama Iluru and Dr. Catherine Havasi, two highly experienced AI experts who will help us better understand the landscape. Rama is currently a senior director at the Special Competitive Studies Project, SCSP, a nonprofit funded by Eric and Wendy Schmidt. You may know that name from Google and Alphabet, that was established to make recommendations to strengthen America's long-term competitiveness for a future where artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies reshape our national security, economy, and society. She leads a team whose mission is to help shape emerging technology governance and intellectual property policy. Previously, she was the director of National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, an independent commission established by Congress to consider the methods and means to advance the development of AI, ML, and associated technologies to address the national security and defense needs of the United States. At the NSCAI, she worked on ethics and responsible AI. She was detailed to the NSCAI from the United States Patent and Trademark Office, where she served as an administrative patent judge on the patent and trial and appeal group. Before joining the USPTO, Rama practiced IP for 20 years, specializing in analyzing and litigating electrical engineering and biopharma patents. She began her career as a software engineer after graduating from Trinity University with a BS in computer science and philosophy, and she later obtained a JD from Washington and Lee School of Law. After law school, she received an MS in biochemistry and molecular biology from Georgetown University. It's amazing. We're lucky to have you, Rama. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'd also like to introduce you to Dr. Catherine Havasi. Catherine is Chief of Innovation and Technology Strategy at Babel Street, a private equity-backed SaaS company providing advanced AI and data analytics solutions to U.S. and international government commercial customers. In Catherine's role at Babel Street, she helps set strategy and technical product direction generally and is leading the company's expansion into the KYC AML markets currently. Prior to Babel Street, Catherine co-founded the Common Sense Computing Initiative, otherwise known as ConceptNet, which was the first crowdsourced project for artificial intelligence and the largest open knowledge graph for language understanding. ConceptNet has played a role in thousands of AI projects for nearly 20 years. She also co-founded DeLang Technologies, which provides AI to the healthcare sector, and also Luminoso, which helps companies get value from customer service data. She was honored as one of the Fast Company's 100 most creative people in business and she directed the Digital Intuition Group at the MIT Media Lab, where she continues as a visiting scientist conducting research related to artificial intelligence and more specifically, computational creativity. Catherine earned her PhD at Brandeis University, where apparently they were really good at Quidditch. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Well, they don't, now you do. They don't have a football program, so that's what they do. Okay, so that's the intros. Obviously, we have a very talented group of women here, and let's get into it. We'll start with some questions off of the first topic, which is, what is generative AI? In the last few months, we've heard a lot about it, and there is a ton of buzz. So, Rama, question for you. As a starting point, will you please define two very important concepts for our audience? First, what is generative AI? And what are large language models, LLMs? And second, how do they actually operate?
First of all, thank you for including me. So AI is a foundational technology like electricity upon which other technologies are built and accelerated. It's a general purpose technology of unlimited possibilities. And there's no universal consensus definition of AI, but there is a common understanding, which is that AI mimics or simulates human thinking and decision-making. It's computational systems like computers or iPhones in your pockets that can ingest vast amounts of data and analyze it by conducting statistical analysis or recognizing patterns. In essence, it's the things that AI learns. And based on this analysis, AI can perform tasks that seem similar to human decision-making or thinking, like making recommendations. And generative AI models are an application of AI. They are trained on large existing data sets, like the internet, and use this data to generate new output and language that can appear to mimic human language and human characteristics. They can generate text, they can generate images, video, as well as audio. And large language models are a type of generative AI models that generate text. Initially, they were designed to predict the next word, the next sentence, the next paragraph, and so on. But what happened as these models grew is that they have demonstrated the ability to solve things like university math questions, score at human levels on LSATs, GREs. And these large language models appear to exhibit intelligence because, as I mentioned earlier, they can generate text that looks like it's being generated by humans. Large language models can perform a wide range of natural language processing tasks. And by natural language, I mean human language. They can generate text in various formats like stories, poetry, news articles, and analyze the meaning of the text, translate text between different languages and writing styles, and extract information for tasks such as sentiment analysis. There are also multimodal language models which can mix and match text and audio and images. For example, there is models that you can use to provide a text prompt that will generate images.
That's interesting. And with all the buzz that you hear today, it feels like ChatGPT is sort of at the core of it. How would you characterize that in the context of what you just said to us?
Well, so I think that was the first sort of leading edge, large, very, very large language model. And I think the best thing that's come out of ChatGPT is that it raised the awareness of artificial intelligence to the masses. It made AI accessible to the layperson, given that chat layer of I give a prompt, the AI model analyzes my prompt and gives me an output. So it's very accessible. Anyone can use it. And I think that's really what's increased awareness of artificial intelligence in the public. And I think the second thing that's come out of this ChatGPT is that the size of these models. These models are huge, cost tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to train. And what the technologists making this own this technology found that as these large models grew, they were even surprised about the capabilities and what they could do.
It's fascinating. And is it safe to assume that models like Bard and ChatGPT are in the same class? I would say yes, right?
They're all very large language models. They're very, very large language models. So I would say that they're in the same class. Capabilities, I think there's, you know, there's differing opinions on which one's better or different capabilities, but yes, same class.
Okay, thank you. And Catherine, so let's broaden the discussion a bit to the other types of AIs. Can you help us understand, you know, what else is in the AI environment? What other technologies exist? What do they do and how they all work together if they interoperate? I know it's a very broad question, but you know.
Okay. Yeah, there's a couple of things I'll take care of. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here chatting with you guys this morning. I think one of the reasons that so generative AI is absolutely AI, right? And all of the as we move forward, it's an AI that's specially designed in the way that Rama spoke about to solve certain kinds of problems and to mimic human-like text. Underneath that is a large language model, which can be used to do a whole lot of different things. But all of AI right now is moving forward. And I think we're sort of, as practitioners, past the point where we think AI will be a black box, where we pour the internet in the top and, you know, human-like intelligence comes out the bottom, where inside there needs to be complexities of different kinds of AIs and different kinds of models working together. When we hear rumors about how ChatGPT-4 or GPT-4 are coming out of OpenAI, it looks like it's going to be what is referred to as a Hydra model, which is many different kinds of models working together to check each other and to try to fix some of these issues. So I think as we move forward, we're definitely going to see AI models specialize and work together to solve problems. I think one of the reasons why we're in a place where this has really entered the public consciousness is because it's so easy for people to understand the power of these models. I mean, chat and conversation is sort of the ultimate user interface. Before computers, it's how we interact with each other. So every time, if you look at the way user interface design has worked, every time a new piece of technology comes out, we try talking to it like we talk to people. When search came out in the 90s, the people here probably remember Hotbot and Lycos and AltaVista and all that stuff. You know, initially people would talk to those search engines. I was working in search at the time, people would talk to those search engines like they would talk to people. They would say things like, oh, my cat is sick, and they would get results that weren't very good. And eventually we learned to do keyword search. When Siri came out, we talked to that, and we didn't really get that far. And same thing with Alexa and so on. So it's how people want to be interacting with tech. And this is the first time it's actually really worked. So I think that's really made an impact. But I think AI as a whole is really where the internet technology was in the late 90s. The fact that we're starting to see and understand the power of it, it's still its own separate category. But where AI is going is that it's going to disappear into all of the other industries. AI is going to become part of all the industries that we are all in, everything from finance to customer experience to marketing. And it's going to become a table stakes part of those industries. These days, we don't ever think of ourselves as working in the internet technology because internet is part of everything. And that's where AI is going to go.
Yeah, it's interesting. You hear a lot about the fear of losing your job to AI. But as we learn more about it, we realize it's probably more of an empowering technology. And something that makes everyone more productive, just like the internet was, or cell phones, or you know those other technologies that were so formative and disruptive in so many ways. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think that also shows you both the good and the bad, right? And I think in the beginning when the internet happened, we didn't think about the risks of the internet. And there was a lot of regulatory choices that we made that maybe now we regret, but the cat is out of the bag. And I think in many ways, we're in the same place with AI, right? Only the internet happened and there were a lot of really good effects of the internet, but there have also been a lot of challenges that have come from the way internet and social media works, you know, and we're talking everything from, you know, mental health of children to ethnic conflicts in Southeast Asia. You know, I think we can see that we're in a position now where we can start thinking about how to build responsible AI uses and what impacts are going to be in a way that maybe we didn't with the internet.
Yeah, thanks. Our second topic is practical applications and opportunities, where we see how, you know, generative AI and AI more broadly is being used today and will be used in the near term. So this is a question for both of you, but let's start with Rama. What about the foreseeable future of AI most excites you?
I think we're living in one of the most exciting times in human history. We may look on our time as the moment civilization was transformed by monumental discoveries, just like we discovered fire, agriculture, and electricity. Electricity, for example, was once a new and mysterious technology, but now it's an essential part of our lives, and it's infused into everything that we do and use. And I think AI will be like that as well. I think the current emerging AI revolution will be the most rapid human transformation in the history of the world because of given the pace of technology, its advancement, as well as its adoption. And with the wave of this technology, I think the world will be very different even next year, and it'll be recognizably different by 2030, say. I'm also thankful that I'm experiencing this revolution in the United States. I think it's at every critical phase of American history, our enduring democratic values have been tested by international forces, tech disruptions, and threats from abroad. And I'm convinced that we're once again in one of those decisive points that will shape America's future. And I'm glad that I am in a society where that future will be shaped by democratic values. For example, there are authoritarian states using the same technology to create surveillance states or oppress minorities. And so I think it is, as Catherine alluded to, that it, you know, we need to shape this technology as we want it, according to our values, our norms, and our principles. And I think if we can harness AI and other emerging technologies, harness the benefits and mitigate the worst of the harms, it will raise the boats for all of society. And so I think that's very exciting.
Thank you very much. Catherine, you got a view on that?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely echo a lot of this. I've been working in AI and in language processing actually for a really long time. So it's tremendously exciting to see the progress we've made and honestly to see people believe in it and to see that we're talking at a CFO summit, right? As opposed to a conference of practitioners. So I think that's really exciting. And I would love to see this really help us make progress on some thorny problems. And, you know, I think we can really transform a lot of industries with it.
So Catherine, can you give us your view on perhaps where you see the greatest opportunities in terms of use cases and impact to particular sectors, you know, so I'll say today or within the next 12 to 18 months?
So I think one of the places we're going to see a lot of impact is this kind of technology's ability to give every one of us sort of superpowers in order to accelerate the operations that we do and in order to augment the things that we work on. So for many, many years, I worked at a department at MIT that physically sits between the business school Sloan and the computer science school and sort of emotionally sat between the two too. So it's probably not a huge surprise, but I'm gonna quote some MIT Sloan and BCG studies. Every year they do a study where they survey executives of Fortune 500 about AI usage. And the executive study from 2020 is the first time they really started having these kinds of discussions. And they found something really interesting, which is that every company that had seen a significant revenue gain from using AI was using AI in a collaborative way. And so this goes beyond the augmentation to really the kinds of systems where people are learning from AI and AI is learning from people at the same time. So there's this back and forth. And 2 years later, they went back and they surveyed the same in 2020, they went back and they surveyed the same people. And one, it was really interesting because obviously there have been huge AI advances. And they noticed that when the groups that were really successful, they were not only augmenting the individuals, but they were also helping those individuals both do their job better and be happier with their job. They said that about 64% of individuals working in organizations that saw a great benefit felt that they personally had seen benefit from AI. And the people who said that were 3.4 times more likely to be satisfied with their job. And interestingly, the majority of people surveyed when given a broad list of different things they could characterize their relationship with AI with, they actually said that they thought of AI as a coworker rather than a tool or a threat, which I think when we look at that result, we can sort of see where we're really going to see the impact, right? Anytime we're looking at operations, and this is from marketing to customer experience to writing an FAQ to match a new, one place we did it was to write an FAQ to, you know, into a new format, right? Any kind of operational task, when there's a repeatable pattern and when there's sort of this thing Rama talked about earlier, where you can understand and extend a pattern, that's a really good place to apply AI. So organizing data, creating first drafts of things, helping people sort through a lot of information and create personal responses in your voice faster are all places we're going to see short-term operational impacts. I think another thing that's critical is monetizing data. So the last couple of years, a lot of organizations have gone through digital transformations of one kind or another, and those have largely been lengthy and difficult processes. And at the end, you end up with a data lake and a data system. And I think in many ways, a lot of companies are still waiting for the bang that went with the buck. And we're going to see a lot of that come out of this kind of data processing, that we're able to be able to look into that information and help companies monetize that either for operational efficiency or I work a lot in financial services. So companies are looking at the information they've had over many years and saying, hey, can we use that to predict fraud? Can we use that to work with our partners in order to better understand what's happening in these transactional patterns?
Thank you. So, you know, many of us in this webinar are obviously, most of us are CFOs. Many are parents and some are even grandparents. We're leaders and mentors of more junior people. And as we think about providing guidance to our employees, kids, grandkids, friends, how should we think about the future of the workspace in light of the emergence of AI in terms of required skills, capabilities, and disciplines that, you know, we'll all need in the future to be competitive? And Rama, this question's for you.
Thanks. So I think it's completely understandable that to be worried about the future of the workforce. But I think those fears have to be balanced by the facts of what these models are capable of, and educating workers of these, you know, profound tech advancements. And I do think that the introduction of AI large language models is a tech game changer. It allows AI, as I said earlier, to be accessible by lay people, creating new use cases that are currently only limited by human creativity. I think I agree with Catherine that I think large language models will transform every industry. I think of AI as electricity upon which other technologies are built. I think companies that harness the power of large language models will have a significant competitive advantage. And we're only at the beginning of seeing the capabilities AI will bring to the workforce. So we'll certainly see more human-machine teaming, as Catherine said, complementing the capabilities and performing tasks that neither a human nor a machine could do on its own, but the human-machine teaming does it together. And I would say that if I was talking to a more junior person, I would make 3 points about AI in the workforce. I would say first, embrace AI as an enabler, not as a replacement. Communicate that AI is there to augment their work, not replace them, and highlight how AI can automate certain tasks. All of us every day do tasks that we don't want to do because they're menial, they're boring. AI can help with that to leave us free to do other things that we do want to do, especially the creative parts of our jobs. The second point I would make is that you should adapt and acquire new skills. Stress the importance of adapting their skills and compatibility capabilities to align with these new technologies and what they're capable of. Emphasize the need for continuous learning as these technologies change. And I think lastly, the point I would make is to nurture human-centric skills. While AI advances, human-centric skills remain valuable. AI mimics humans, but they're not humans. So we have skills that are more valuable than what machines can do. So we need to harness those skills. So I think by effectively communicating these concise messages, we can guide junior people better to harness the benefits of these technologies. And I also want to point out that those last three points were from a large language model. I asked it what three points to make about AI in the workforce.
So can you give some examples of the types of human-centric skills that you are thinking?
Sure.
Sales, the ability to communicate, those types of things. But what do you think?
Absolutely. So, we talk a lot about EQ, for example, right? There's, I think possibly it's possible to teach an AI those kinds of skills. But in our communication, especially for customer service, I think those kinds of skills are going to just become more valuable, right? Because those can't be replaced. So maybe you have the natural human language communication that's replaceable with AI. But there are those EQ skills as well as creativity, human creativity. I think AI can create, obviously, but there's things like human creativity that can't be replaced. So I think there is the humanness. I think it's just going to become more valuable.
That's great. Thank you. Okay, switching gears completely. Let's pivot to the challenges, risks, and concerns associated with all this. So this will be a question for both of you. We'll start with Catherine. But Catherine, what does responsible AI look like to you?
Well, I'm not sure you should start with me, honestly, because I think Rama probably has been doing a lot more work in this area, but I can talk a little bit. So I think one of the things we have to do is really what's called human-centered AI design, and we have to think about the impacts of everything we're building and what it has and the impacts on people around us. And that's everything from how do we empower to where are the risks. And I think if we build from there, from the ground up, that's a good start. I'm a big advocate for explainability, right? I think explainability is extremely important in putting AI into especially regulated industries where I tend to work. That transparency is going to be critical in order to build trust. And building that trust and deserving that trust is going to be the most important thing that we can do in order to be able to actualize the potential that we see in these technologies.
It's interesting when you talk about explainability because, aside from machine learning, some earlier AI technologies that I've been exposed to forever, basically, my first real foray into AI was reading a book by Eric Schmidt. I think it was called The Age of AI. Really good book if you haven't read it. But a lot of what gets done is sort of done in a black box that cannot be explained. And in fact, in certain situations, decisions get made so fast, you don't have time to explain. For example, if I'm in a wartime situation and AI has been unleashed as a defensive or offensive technology, win or loss, the win or loss outcome is often determined by speed of decision making in addition to the quality of decision making. So that's a very difficult thing for me to understand personally. Rama, do you have a view on that? And also, can you also address that as part of the initial question, which is what you think responsible AI looks like? And I guess just expand on that a little bit more to share perhaps what your top three areas of risk are in your viewpoint.
Sure.
Being mitigated?
Sure. I think that, as I said earlier, the United
States... Uh-oh. Okay, technical difficulties here. Hang on one second. We may have to come back to Rama if she doesn't rematerialize in a moment. Oh, here she is. Okay, you're back.
Oh,
go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. Must be our Wi-Fi here. So I think it's really important that the U.S. present a democratic model of AI development and use for the global stage. We are in a global competition with authoritarian states right now. And we need to present a model that will be adopted globally as far as how AI is developed, how it's used, its impacts on society. And so I think it's, you know, given, I think Congress and the administration have recognized the importance of shaping AI technologies according to our values. And there's been a lot of efforts in both Congress and the administration to see that it is shaped in according to democratic values. As far as explainability, I would say that it also depends on context, right? And explainability to who. So if the Netflix, AI-enabled Netflix recommends a movie to me, I don't really need to know how it came about that recommendation. But if a doctor is using AI to diagnose whether I have cancer or not, I might want to know more about how the doctor used AI, whether he or she used AI, how the AI went about analyzing whether I have cancer or not. And I think so there's explainability to me, but there's also explainability to the doctor, right, who gets the AI output and says, well, is this something I should communicate to my patient or not? Or how reliable is this? So I think explainability and its importance really depends on the context.
Catherine, while we wait for Rama to come back,
there is one thing I want to react to. One of the she's back. Again. She's
back. Okay. Go ahead, Rama. Please continue. You were talking about explainability for 10, 15 seconds.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know why the Wi-Fi is bad here. Okay. So I think explainability really depends on context and to who. Again, if you know there are certain circumstances, it doesn't really matter. If you know low risk circumstances, scenarios where it doesn't matter how the AI came up with its output. But there are high stakes areas, for example, healthcare, medicine, national security, where it really does matter, where you really want to know how the AI came up with its output, whether it's recommending something or whether it comes up with an answer. It's really important to know how the AI came up with that decision.
How does that actually happen given the nature of these methods? How do you veracity of the outcome? I'm perplexed by this. I don't understand.
So I think it's a complicated problem that technologists are working on right now. So for example, let's say I want to know what data was used to come up with the decision that the AI. So it would be great if there were AI models that could tell you what pieces of data were touched in its analysis and coming up with this decision. And technologists are working on that, for example, with watermarking or certain standards that tell you which data was used, what data the model used in coming up with its output.
So Brian, to perhaps make it a little bit concrete, there are two places where we work on this that I think are relevant, exactly what Rama was saying with what we call attribution, which is being able to look back at our data library and say, hey, if we came up with a conclusion, can we point to the exact data that was used in coming up to that conclusion? That's one thing that you can do. And I think it's also often a misconception that debiasing or adding explainability affects performance, either speed or accuracy in all cases. To ground it again in what we do at Babel Street, we have a product that is used for doing a lot of financial service compliance. So name screening, sanction screening, et cetera. It's also used when you come into the country, you put your passport down, it checks you to see that you're who you say you are. So between all those use cases, we process maybe 700 million names a day, if not more. And it's really the backbone of some of the financial system. And that technology is running very fast in order to hit those things. And it is explainable, right? And it was built to be explainable because it's a regulated industry. If we say you're a sanctioned individual, we need to be able to say why. So it comes into a design question. It's a technical question, but it's not necessarily a blocker.
The question is it going to be a requirement for businesses and other organizations to make critical decisions? It seems to me that it will be. Do you have a view?
In some places it already is.
Right. Okay. Okay. So Rama, can you speak about ethics?
And sure. Sure. Again, going back to responsible AI. So in the US, we have a culture of innovation, right? So how do you balance innovation against regulation as well? So one of the recommendations that we've made is that we should focus our regulatory efforts on the worst cases, the worst use cases. So trying to figure out how AI impacts society, what are the benefits, what are the harms, and analyzing that to see where we should be regulating, how we should be governing. So, and by governing, I mean regulation as well as non-regulatory governance mechanisms. So for example, self-governance by companies, advocacy, philanthropy, recourse, those are all mechanisms that we can use to shape the use and the development of AI to align with our values.
And is it your view that we can remain competitive in the world stage with governance that many other foreign actors simply don't have? Or do you believe that that's going to govern progress in some way?
I do. I do believe that we can have both. I think American can lead in this technology as well as govern it so that it is aligns with our values. So, you know, we are leading. I would say the US is leading in AI. It's leading in software. It's leading in large language models. The hardware components are, the competition for hardware is a little more closer. And so even though the US is leading in AI, I would say it's a pretty close competition with China. However, I think that we can still lead in that competition and govern these technologies the way we want it to, the way we want. I think that we have to act now. And as I said earlier, the administration and Congress have taken, or at least recognize that this is something that needs to be done now. I would say that, for example, with respect to social media companies about 10, 15 years ago, we did not do a great job of governing it, but I think we have learned some lessons there and have started trying to put some guardrails around this technology so that we can lead in innovation, harness the benefits, and protect our society.
Thank you. Okay. As a time check, it's 12:45. We're going to try to answer the final section, which is the future of AI, answer a couple questions, and then we'll wrap it up and try to get you all out of here by 5 till so you can get ready for your next meetings. So as we move into this final section, we're going to cover the future of AI and particularly generative AI. So obviously the technology is evolving at a very, very fast pace. Where are we today? And how do you see this playing out over the next 1 to 3 years? This is a question for Catherine.
Sure. I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about where we think AI is going to have a big impact. So I think some of that has been covered. I think what we're going to see is hopefully sort of exactly what Rama was talking about with finding a place where we can still continue to lead in the world stage, but we've figured out how to mitigate some of the risks as well. But I think what's going to happen is that AI is going to become part of many applications, from marketing to, you know, a spreadsheet where instead of setting up a pivot table, you can type in what you want and it figures out how to do it, to any other kinds of applications. And I think we're going to see AI become more pervasive. We're going to see the platform companies continue to build out platforms, but primarily a lot of the impact will be made inside of the last mile of taking these tools, which are just another tool, and figuring out how to apply them in novel ways in order to sort of facilitate and speed up operations of different parts and functions of a business. And I think that's going to be, I think there are going to be some really fun applications that are going to come out. I think we're going to start seeing interesting applications in entertainment already. But I think on the flip side of that, we're going to see that's going to be another place where regulation pushes back. So we're already seeing AI play a role in something like the writer's strike or the actor's strike that are out there as well. So we can, entertainment, customer experience, places like that are going to be a forefront for both the pluses and the minuses of this.
Yeah. And Rama, where do you see the potential trajectories of this technology?
So I think
a few years out, and even further, if you can. I realize it's very difficult.
Sure. I think it is hard to precisely predict. But however, I think that, you know, we've already seen a few number of these large language models thrive, and I think we'll see them grow even further, probably like 10x times what we've seen so far. I think we'll see large language models that start using different software tools as subroutines, including like search engines, calculators, route planners, et cetera. I think we'll see a larger number of more specialized systems, large language models that are fine-tuned for specific tasks. I think we will, all, for example, in medicine or law, we're already seeing that. I think we'll also see the costs of training some of these large models, language models come down and making them more efficient. I think we will have some technical solutions for some of the issues we're facing now, like hallucinations, which is where a large language model is so eager to provide an answer that it just makes up facts. I think we will also, I don't think we'll completely solve the issue of bias, because I think bias is something that is inherent to humans, and you know, it's humans that are making these technologies, but I think we will at least have tools to better understand and be more aware of how models present bias. I think we'll also see a lot more open source models, a lot of open source large language models, a lot of smaller models. I think those will really proliferate. So I think we will eventually have a generative AI ecosystem that is both proprietary models as well as open source models.
Yeah, you know, that's when we were talking earlier yesterday or the day before, as we were planning, we talked a little bit about sort of the accessibility to the compute necessary to train the models, and in many cases that it's extreme cost, right? It could be millions or tens of millions of dollars. But you noted that with some of the open source models and some other service offerings that are being put out into the market, there's more of a democratization of the whole thing. I hate to use that word, it's so trivial, but you get the point. How can you talk more about that and how a smaller firm can compete against the big technology giants that are so well capitalized?
Sure. So I think until recently, it was a large incumbent companies like Google and Meta that have been able to make a lot of money by effectively deploying AI. And getting the big returns from AI has been tough for startups. For a lot of AI products, as we've talked about, the compute cost for the initial training is really high. And then you get diminishing margins as you try to, for example, let me give you accuracy. So there are some contexts where accuracy is really important. So you can get up to 80%, but that 10 to 20% more is 10x, 100x the initial investment. So even if you can scale up to that 100% accuracy, it's a lot of cost. And startups have a hard time with that. I think generative AI sort of changes that dynamic, because there are certainly different use applications that you can build on top of the large language models that are already present, services that you can provide on top of those large language models. So I think that that's how startups can compete. And like also they can take off the shelf open source models, fine tune them for certain applications and commercial uses.
Thanks very much. Okay. So we've got 10 minutes left. We're going to try to get out early, as I promised. We have two questions in the Q&A. I'll put them out there to the panelists, and you guys can handle them as you see fit. Mohan asked the first. And here's the question. When you do a search using Google, it searches the entire internet. Language models are also trained using a lot of information on the web. Are there lots of similarities in how search engines answer search and ChatGPT answers prompts? Can one of you two answer that? You know, I think it's, yeah, go ahead. Rama, you look like you're thinking
about it. I welcome Catherine's help on this, but
I actually didn't hear the question. I apologize. I lost audio in the middle of that.
Okay, I'll try one more time. Are there similarities in how search engines answer search questions and ChatGPT answers prompts? That's the question. I think the question is how do they, I think they're fundamentally different, but perhaps you can briefly
explain. I'll give a shot at this. Yeah, I think they're pretty different, right? When there's a lot that goes into play with a search engine, but fundamentally what a search engine is trying to do is it has a lot of different individual documents, and its goal is to return to you the document that it thinks you are most likely to spend a long time reading or most likely to answer your question. And that's typically been the goal of the search engine, is to find and retrieve a document. When you look at the conversational AI search engines like Bing, what they're trying to do is help you find the information you're looking for, even if the information is sourced from a couple of documents or sourced from deep within a document. So it's really about taking the information and not necessarily just matching the query to a document, but taking the information and really deeply understanding what it means in order to put together a question, an answer to a question. So I think they're a little bit different. I think it's really interesting. I get asked a lot whether or not I think every search is going to be conversational, right? And somebody who's worked in search, certainly there's a lot of search where conversational search is clearly superior. If you've ever tried to, like, I'll use Bing or a conversational search engine to be able to plan travel, right? Not book flights, but figure out what I want to do or where I want to go in a place, because it's just a better user interface. But sometimes you need to find a document, right? If I've got a big pile of documents in a corporate repository and I need to just load the contract I sent to the customer, I don't need to have a conversation about that. I need to find the document. So I think we're going to see a little bit of both. And a lot of the legacy players like LinkedIn, Pinterest, Salesforce, et cetera, you know, where you can see both applications, I think we're going to see them be a little bit more conservative about moving towards something like a Bing chat.
And here's how I think about it. So I think in a conventional search engine, it's a one-to-one match, right? If I'm looking for a certain document or I'm planning a certain trip, I have put in a word, it goes through its databases to see if it finds that word, and it gives, you know, the 10 best results, whatever. And something like ChatGPT, it's using statistics, I'll call it statistics, machine learning, to make inferences about your search. So even if it doesn't find a one-to-one match, it's making inferences and providing you with an answer that it thinks is best fits your prompt.
Thank you. One final question. Ron, I'll point this one toward you. Are there commercial KYC tools today that are connected to compliance regulations? For example, sanctions list checking as meeting responsibly under the law and regulation. Safe harbor, just by using tool tech, for example. And Catherine, feel free to also jump in if you have a view. This is in the general chat.
And can you tell me what KYC stands for?
Know your customer.
Yeah. I'm not really aware of any commercial tools. I'm sure they're out there, however, especially since those compliance regulations are public. I'm sure that there are tools that are being built today to make those matches and make those analysis. So I suspect they're probably already there, or at least are on the horizon.
There are a lot of problems that there are a lot of problems that look like this, which is globally, there are a lot of different regulations in a lot of different countries, and they're changing all the time. And as somebody who is in operations of the company, you sort of need to understand that. And that can be everything from, hey, what are customs regulations? I need to ship a thing globally, and it's always changing what I'm allowed to ship and what I have to pay to ship in different places, down to, you know, compliance regulations. Is there AI right now that can help you by figuring out whether or not you're in compliance? I think there are a lot of companies that are starting to play around in that space a little bit. But I think it's something where those companies are all smaller and the risk of making mistakes is very big. So it's a little bit of a hard space to innovate in. But absolutely, especially the shipping side and the logistics side, there's a real need for that. And I think it can be a really hard question on how do you keep on top of all the regulations.
Okay. Well, fascinating discussion today. Thank you to the panelists. We are on, you know, at the top of the hour. So I want to thank everyone who participated. I thought this was a really interesting session, and I hope to see more on the topic. Joe, I'll hand it over to you to wrap us up.
Yeah, this will be quick, but Brian and Catherine and Rama, you know, excellent presentation. It was fantastic. I think this qualifies as one of the best events we've had on the Tech CFO Network, and hopefully you'll let us, do a follow-up invitation sometime, 6 to 12 months from now, which seems to be a lifetime in this technology. But great job. Appreciate everything you do for us. For the Tech CFO Network, we're going to have, we're doing our next event, which will be announced. It's probably going to be in October. We're trying to do an in-person dinner type event, probably October, maybe early November. But anyways, appreciate you all turning out. Hopefully you enjoyed this. And if you got any other great topics and speakers you want to hear, reach out to somebody on the steering committee and let us know. Anyways, thank you, everybody. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Kate, thanks for all your efforts to get this done for us.
Thanks, Kate.